Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Sutai Vampir and Jajim Vestai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome, warriors, to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jajim.
And I am Jorn. And with us today is the creator of that language that you all hold dear, Klingon Hall. Welcome, Mark Okrand.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. That's cool. So, I thought we would start out by just asking you a few questions. You live out there in Washington, D.C. I'm in Nebraska, and John is down in Florida.
Okay. So we're about, a triangle from each other.
I don't know why, Mark. I just kind of assumed you were on the West Coast, I guess, because you worked with the films. You created the Klingon language for the movies, starting with the third movie,
right?
Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a teeny bit of Klingon language before that.
Okay.
In the first movie, there's nothing in the original series. They mention the existence of a language,
right?
In Trouble with Tribbles, but nobody speaks it.
And not only that, but the language they mentioned in all of Star Trek, the original series, is Klingonese.
They call it Klingonese, right.
Not Klingon Hole, which is what you came up with.
Right. That's the way, because Klingon Hole is Klingon for Klingon. And Klingonese, I guess, is English.
Tell us how you got involved with making up a language.
Well, they hired me. They literally called and said, do you want to do this? But the reason they called me as opposed to calling somebody else is because I made up a little bit of Vulcan for Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. So I was sort of their language guy, I guess.
Oh, I see. So in other words, the conversation between Spock and Savick, that's your work.
Yeah, that scene was originally filmed, when they filmed it, the actors were speaking English because, the script said to speak English. And in post-production, for a number of reasons, they decided that they should be speaking Vulcan to each other. So they had the idea of hiring a linguist from UCLA. I have no idea who they had in mind, to come over and look at the scene that was already filmed and listen to it and see what they were saying and look at the actor's lips and basically make up gobbledygook that matched the lips. And then they would dub it in and put in subtitles. And they changed the subtitles slightly from what the actors were saying, which they thought was a good idea, much cheaper than shooting the scene all over again to get the dialogue to say what they wanted it to say. But anyway, for some reason or other, whoever they were going to work with at UCLA, it wasn't working out, not for any bad reasons, but it was, just the schedules and stuff like that. And I happened to be at Paramount for unrelated reasons and heard about this and sort of volunteered myself, and they hired me. In fact, there's a little bit more to it than that, because I knew Harv Bennett, who was the, I guess his title was executive producer for that film. I knew him from years and years ago. And even though he wasn't involved with the conversation that I, when I volunteered, it was ultimately his decision to hire me. So he wasn't hiring someone he never heard of. But that's not why I was there. It was all a big coincidence. And so I ended up doing that short little scene. And made up some gibberish that hopefully matched the lip movements reasonably well. And then about a year and a half later, Harv called and said, well, we're making another movie. And, you did the Vulcan for Star Trek II. Do you want to do the Klingon for Star Trek III? And that's how that came about.
Neat. So have you made up languages for other franchises?
I have, but not before this. Klingon was the first. Because Vulcan in Star Trek II, I wouldn't call making up a language exactly. Mm-hmm. Because it was just sounds to match up with the lip movements. But Klingon was, from the get-go, was a real language for me. Now, the Klingon that existed before, which was in Star Trek The Motion Picture, that was basically audio. Actually, there's a whole complicated history for that, which I don't know quite completely. Okay. But where that came from is they knew when they put the film together, I mean, when they were planning the film, that the little Klingon scene at the very, very beginning of the film was going to be in Klingon with this new, or whatever they called it, Klingonese, whatever they called it. But it was going to be in that language. They knew that all the time. Even though I believe the scene was filmed sort of late in the game, at the end of the production phase. Anyway, they hired a linguist from UCLA, another guy named Harmut Scharf, who's specialized in languages from India and around there. So the languages related to Sanskrit, Hindi, and things like that. And he made up this Klingon language for that scene. Actually, for a little bit more, because you know, when you make a movie, you always end up making more than what ends up in the final cut. And for some reason or other, they didn't like it. The producers didn't like it. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. And so they wrangled Jimmy Doohan along with one of the producers named John Polville, and Jimmy and John Polville together made up a new version of what this language is going to sound like. Now, whether any of that incorporated any of the stuff that Scharf had done, I have no idea. And that's what you hear. That's what you hear is the stuff that James Doohan and John Polville came up with. And it was basically they wanted it to sound cool. They weren't thinking so much about grammar and vocabulary and all that. Maybe a little bit, but not all that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think I've heard you say before that the little bits that they made up with the subtitles gave you trouble when you were coming up with the Klingon language?
It gave me the start, actually. It didn't give me trouble because I had to incorporate that into whatever it is I did because that was the real language. So I had to figure out that, I guess the trouble was I had to figure out what they were saying. You know, if he says, the phrase "Cha-Yerush," is that one word or two words or three words? I don't know. Nobody knows. So I had to make decisions like that and then use that as a basis for what I came up with. So all of the sounds and syllable types that they made up for the motion picture, I used as a starting point. So I didn't start from zero. I started from Star Trek One, Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Yeah. So, it boggles my mind to think about making up a language just boom out of the blue and a whole new language, especially when you consider how difficult just English is for people from other countries to understand because of the little idiosyncrasies we have. How in the world do you even approach making up an entire language?
Well, you approach it kind of systematically. Step one is figure out why you're doing it. Actually, and that's key to making up a language. And for me, for Klingon, that was pretty straightforward. I was doing it for a movie. I knew who the Klingons were. So it's not like I had to invent a whole culture and stuff like that. Although we didn't know all that much about Klingons at that time, but still we knew something. So I had that to kind of in the back of my mind all the time as I was going forward. And I knew what the Klingons had to say. In other words, they gave me the script. Mm. And my job was to come up with lines that matched the script, a Klingon version of all the things the Klingons were supposed to say in Klingon. Huh. So even though, you know, sort of as shorthand, we say I made up a language for Star Trek III, I really only made up the skeleton of a language for Star Trek III. I sort of liken what I did to building a movie set. You know, if you build a set for a movie, you don't build the whole thing. If the thing takes place, the plot takes place in a house in somebody's living room. You don't build the whole living room, you only build the part that the camera will show, right? Mm-hmm. And if there's a window or a door, but no one ever walks through that door, when they build the set, the door doesn't open. It looks like it opens, but it doesn't, because why bother to put in all that hardware and stuff if no one's ever going to need to use it?
Yeah, true.
And it was the same thing with the language. I only made up what was needed for the film. But in the same way, when you build a set, you know, if you build a door that doesn't open, you still understand how it opens, and you know what you would do if someone changed their mind and said, hey, they better open that door. With the language, it was the same thing. I built enough of it that it worked, and if someone said, hey, what about this, I knew how to add on to it.
Ah. So did you ever imagine that we would come to the point where we are now, where we have actually conversational Klingon?
No, never, never, never. When I was working on the film, because I was on set for Star Trek III, and I was on set, you know, and worked with the actors, coached the actors, and in almost every scene where you see people speaking Klingon, I'm just outside the frame. Not all the time, but most of the time. And while I was doing it, you know, I thought I had made up dialogue, you know, for the film. The same way the set designer made up a cool set, I made up some cool dialogue, and it was for the movie, and that's all, I thought. Mm. But there was a lot of interest on the part of the movie making crew in the language. They kept coming up to me and asking questions and stuff. I got to thinking, you know, if these guys are interested in this language, there's Star Trek fans out there. Maybe they're interested in the language too. Mm. So I proposed the idea of writing a book about how the language works, and the powers that be, you know, at Paramount said, okay. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's what it boiled down to. And I wrote this book called The Klingon Dictionary that was supposed to come out when the movie came out, Star Trek III, but for all kinds of boring and bureaucratic reasons, it didn't. It came out about 6 months or so later, which turned out to be a good thing, and we can talk about that later if you want. But anyhow, The book came out, and it sold okay. And then a few years later, they wanted a second edition of the book to incorporate more of the language, because it got used again in Star Trek V and VI, and by that point, the Next Generation was getting going and stuff like that. So that book came out, and after that, I got a call or an email or something from somebody who said he was in charge of something called the Klingon Language Institute, which I'd never heard of. What is that? And it turns out it's a bunch of people who were, on the basis of the book, you know, studying and learning the language and stuff. And that's the first time I heard that people were paying attention to it other than just kind of, you know, glancing at the book and this is fun, here's the word for house, you know, and put the book back down. But people were taking it very, very seriously. I had no idea that was going to happen. I knew people would be interested and have a good time looking at it, but I didn't know people were going to study it to be able to speak it and carry on conversations.
The Klingon Language Institute tends to have a meeting nationally every year, and my understanding is they expect several new words out of you every year.
Yeah, it used to be several. Now it's a lot. I think the last time was 100 or so words, yeah.
That's good to be a lot.
So the language,
did you ever hear that story on NPR about two decades ago? There was an NPR commentator who was stuck in the middle of Japan, and everybody in Japan, everybody around him on the train station, spoke Japanese and not a word of English. And he didn't speak a word of Japanese. But this kid walked by with a t-shirt on that said, I speak Klingon. The commentator also had learned the language and finally got himself back to Tokyo through this kid's help.
Well, I've never heard that. I'm going to have to look
that up. Was about two decades ago on NPR.
NPR archives or something. Wow.
Your language is useful.
Yeah, oh, there's no question about that. Yeah.
So, Mark, have you always been a Star Trek fan?
Yeah, but that's the short answer. when Star Trek was brand new, you know, the original series was brand new, is when I was in college. And at that time, you know, unlike now, people didn't have TVs in their dorm rooms so much. So people didn't watch, college students who living in the dorm stuff didn't watch as much TV as they did when they were living at home and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I was aware of Star Trek, but didn't watch it every week, didn't have access to it. You know, every once in a while, I'd be at somebody's house who had a TV and would see it. So I didn't start really paying attention. I mean, I knew who Mr. Spock was and stuff like that, but I didn't start really paying attention until it went into reruns like most other people, you know, Mm-hmm. And that's when it got going. But when I became, you know, a real fan is after I was, you know, roaming around on the Genesis planet with Krug and things like that.
When you got to play with the toys, eh?
Yes, yes.
Speaking of playing with things, when did you start putting those puns into the language?
What puns?
Oh, that's what all my teachers of Klingon have told me, is you were a punster. And there are
actually,
puns.
That started, you know, with the original version of the dictionary. I put in a few little puns and a few, you know, some of my friends' names became words and stuff like that.
You tuckerized them.
But I had no idea two things. I had no idea that anybody would figure them out. They might figure out a couple of the puns, but there weren't very many in the original dictionary. And I didn't know that it was going to expand. So, you know, there's a lot of vocabulary in Klingon that's bad puns.
Yeah.
Or esoteric references. And sometimes people figure out, and sometimes I'm really surprised how clever people are in figuring some of these things out. But they also figure out things that are not there at all. They just, oh, look at this. This must be a pun that means this and that. And it doesn't. I have no idea how they came up with that.
Or, like me, I come up with puns I didn't mean to come up with.
Exactly. Yeah, that happened a few times too.
So, John, did you have any other question?
None that I can think of offhand.
Okay. So the reason we're here today is to talk about your book, Mark, The Klingon Way, A Warrior's Guide.
Right.
Which is a collection of, I guess you would say, Klingon sayings that were used in the television series and movies.
And more.
And more, yeah. He's got some in there that aren't in the things, but make sense.
Yeah. So, you know, go ahead and tell us about the book and how you chose to bring this to be. And
yeah, actually, the book, the idea for the book was not mine. It was the publisher's, Pocket Books. And they kind of came up with this. And the original title of the book, actually, was the Klingon Book of Virtues, is what it was supposed to be called.
Mm.
But they couldn't call it that because there was another book that was written a few years earlier called The Book of Virtues. It was written by William Bennett, who was Secretary of Education. And there was a whole copyright thing about whether or not it was not so much copyright because it's not exactly the same title, but there was some concern about the two books being mixed up somehow. I don't know how people would mix up the Book of Virtues with the Klingon Book of Virtues. But in any event, they changed the title to The Klingon Way. And it was supposed to be exactly, you know, what it turned out to be, which is a collection of Klingon sayings, giving sort of a guide to being a Klingon or insight into Klingon beliefs and culture and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I went about doing it, and it was supposed to be obviously, you know, in the Klingon language, not just English. And the way I went about doing it is I looked at all the episodes of Star Trek that had Klingons either saying something that gave insight of this type, or somebody else talking about the Klingons that I might be able to make use of. And when I say I watched them, it wasn't as easy as it is now to watch all the episodes at that time. So they sent me the scripts for every episode in The Next Generation.
That's one heavy bookcase.
Yeah. And I went through every script looking for anything about Klingons. I knew ahead of time. I was able to figure out which ones were the most likely ones, because some episodes didn't have any Klingons except Worf, you know, and wasn't talking about any Klingon thing in particular. So I went through that and wrote down everything. All these things that different Klingons said, or things that people said about the Klingons, and that was the primary source. A little bit from Deep Space Nine already at that point too, and that was the primary source for where these things came from. And then I just made stuff up, you know, thought about what would Klingons say, you know, above and beyond the things that I'd found in the episodes already. And the inspiration for those came from, I don't know where they came from. I mean, I actually did look at various books of proverbs from various cultures and things like that to get ideas. And some of them are obvious. If you go through the thing, you can see what English aphorism or whatever they're based on. But most of them came from the series, and some just came from the clouds.
Okay. Wow. So it's a great book. It's not available, unfortunately, as new copies. I went on Amazon and I found a copy of it from a place called Thrift Books for $8. And
believe it or not, that's a good price.
Yeah. They sent, well, it was started, that was the least expensive one, and I'll tell you what, it's in great shape. I mean, there's not a bit of a problem with it.
I wonder if you have the first or second printing of it.
I don't know.
And the reason I ask that is because they're slightly different. Different. Usually a reprinting, you know, second, third, fourth printing is identical to the first. So okay. It's slightly different because there was a major typo in the first printing, not of my doing. The book, you know, is all the sayings, right? But there's also pictures. There's lots of pictures taken from the various series of Klingons, and the pictures have captions, you know, saying, you know, what it's a picture of and what episode it's from, maybe, or something. I don't know.
Yes.
And I didn't have anything to do with those. I had nothing to do with choosing the pictures and nothing to do with the captions.
So this one has the pictures.
Yeah. Yeah, they both do.
Okay.
But in the first printing, one of the pictures has a caption that's wrong. It misidentifies the actor or the episode or something. So they reprinted it to make that correction. And I said, well, as long as you're reprinting it, let's go in and fix some of the typos that I found in the Klingon. But they're slightly different, the two printings.
Okay.
The first printing, and I'm a little disappointed with you, Mark. When you signed my copy, you didn't do the Larry Niven trick of going through and correcting all the typos. Yeah, he did that to my copy of A Molten God's Eye.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Had I done that, we'd probably still be sitting there to this day.
I'm not sure how to tell.
It's a long drive back from Indianapolis.
I don't know. I'm not sure how to tell which edition this one is.
Look at the numbers.
Well, it has numbers.
There's numbers
on the page after the title page.
Well, it says first printing in 1996, and then it's 2 through 10.
Down at the bottom, there's numbers.
Just okay, it's numbers. 2 through 10. That's the second printing.
Right.
Okay, I thought so because I did not find any typos that stuck out to me or any incorrect identifications on any of the pictures, so I got the good one.
But we weren't proofreading it either.
No, but I can't help but catch them sometimes. That's kind of the curse of being a teacher, you know.
Yeah.
Curse of knowing spelling and doing some editing. Oh God.
Yes.
Some of these books that I've been reading.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So anyway, we thought what we would do is John and I have chosen our top 10 each from the Klingon Way, and I thought we would go with a countdown style from 10 to 1, and what we'll do is we'll read our selections. I'll go first, and then John will go, because John's got the number 1 that probably is the best, and we'll comment on what they kind of mean to us a little bit briefly, and then turn it over to you, and you can tell us if we're right, wrong, or either way.
All right. We'll see what happens.
And just to start out, we only came up with, we did these separately, and we only have one that's exactly the same on both lists.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. So I kind of took it more from I don't know, you might say a self-help kind of angle, things that I thought would speak to me personally and translate over into being human. So the first, my number 10.
Just a second, Jim. And the way I came up with the list is I'm trying to push people within the Klingon Assault Group to do more things at conventions. particularly give sermons on Klingon culture, either within a panel or impromptu. So I was looking for things that somebody could grab onto and expound on.
You know, before we get into this, speaking of Klingon culture, when I did the language originally, Star Trek III, we didn't know very much about Klingon culture. All we knew is what we learned in the original series, and the Klingons in the original series.
And even there, Kalis wasn't even right.
Yeah, the Klingon in the original series, they were sort of the most popular villains or adversaries, I guess. But they were actually weren't major characters in more than, I don't know, 3-4 episodes. They were in other episodes. But in terms of storylines, they were only major parts of 3 or 4 episodes. Nevertheless, they were everybody's favorite adversary. So we knew about that, but not very much. And I knew about whatever I could glean about Klingons from the script for Star Trek III, right? But that's it. And at the time, you know, we talked about Klingon being a warrior culture and all that stuff. That was basically it. And there's not much more we knew about them than that. And the elaboration of Klingon culture came later. It came with the Next Generation. Is when we learned a whole lot more. So, you know, fortunately for the book, The Klingon Way, it came out after we learned a whole lot more about Klingons. If there was such a book that came out after Star Trek III, all of the phrases would have been about fighting and probably not much more.
Right. Well, you know, as you say, Klingons in the original series, there were maybe 3 episodes that really featured Klingons, and the rest of them, they were just kind of stock bad guys.
Right.
And all 3 of those are on the cover of your book.
Yes. The 3 guys, yeah.
Oh, yes. Now, so there are 7 episodes that feature, well, that have Klingons involved in the original series. And, you know, 4 of those they're just kind of there.
They're just, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I'll start with my number 10. It is pay no heed to globflies. Okay. I've learned a long time ago, there are 3 kinds of people in the world. There's rhinos, cows, and big mouth frogs. Okay. And the rhinos tend to charge ahead. Cows just kind of follow along without questioning. Big mouth frogs just sit and croak at those who are actually doing something. Those are the globflies.
Uh-huh.
They never do anything but criticize, complain, and condemn, and they are the ones who try to bring out dishonor in others and are to be avoided. The warrior's purpose is to honor and duty, and one should never let someone take that from them. So what do you think, Mark?
I think that's great. I think it's a really good interpretation of globflies. The idea of globflies, which is a chalab hilme in Klingon, that wasn't mine. A writer of one of the episodes came up with this notion of glob flies, but in terms of the phrase, I think you got it exactly right. Is don't pay attention to that stuff that's just hot air or irritation or something like that. The way you phrased it was very very good.
Yeah, they don't bite, they don't sting, they're just kind of annoying.
Just shumeng, don't worry about them. You got other things to do.
There you go. All right, John, you're number 10.
Better to die on your feet than to live on your knees. In this case, what we're looking at is doing. We're looking at the ability of someone to decide on their own actions, decide if they're going to follow somebody, and follow through on those actions rather than being forced to do what someone else wants and maybe they don't agree with the premise for those actions, don't agree with what that person is forcing them to do. So, you know, better to die on your feet. Act.
Right. Yeah, actually, that line is from Star Trek VI. Azetbur, who's the daughter of the assassinated chancellor, right, who takes over, she's the one who says that. And I think what she's saying there is it's better off trying than to just give up and live by the rules of somebody else We might not succeed, but we're better off trying because the alternative is worse. The alternative of living, you know, under the subjugation of these other guys is worse. I think that's what she was talking about, and what you said fits in with that.
And frankly, if you do something on your own, if you try, and it fails, then you know that it doesn't work, and not somebody else may have sabotaged it.
Exactly.
All right, my number 9. The wind does not respect a fool. There are things we can control and things we cannot. And when I think back over my life and see the amount of time I've spent trying to change things I can't, I'm disappointed in how I didn't spend more time trying to change the things I could. Kayla told a story about a warrior who decided to stand outside the walls of Quinlot during a deadly storm. He probably thought he was being very courageous, but he lost his life for no good reason. He only proved to himself to be a fool by taking on a foe he could not possibly defeat.
Right, and that's exactly where this line comes from. It's from that story, that tale of about that guy. I think this idea that, you know, there's some opponents, some adversaries that you know you can't beat. So don't try. Mm-hmm. Don't waste your time doing that, because it's going to get you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
No, try your best and all that kind of stuff. But if you know ahead of time that it's not going to work out, then no, don't do that. Why bother?
Yeah, my principal, my second year teacher teaching, gave me a piece of advice, and he said, fight the battles you can win.
Right, right.
And that has been something that's helped me a great deal during my years. Okay, John, you're number 9.
Well, I'm going to throw my 8 and 9 together because they're basically the same idea. Number 8 is, if you cannot fail, you cannot succeed. And number 9 is, if you are afraid to die, you have already died. Both of which are, you've got to commit to what it is that you're going to do. Because what you're going to do has to work in your mind before you can make it work in the real world. If you think your project is not going to work, you're going to act in a way that the project won't work. If you are afraid to die, then, well, especially when I was in the SCA, when you start learning medieval combat, you're hesitant to get hit, all right? And that hesitancy to get hit is the motivating factor for the other man to come in and clean your clock, and you're done. So if you're afraid to die, you're going to get clocked. But if you have decided that you can go in and you can block and you can take the blow, you're 100% ahead of most everybody else in that tourney.
Right. Yeah. For that one, I think the idea is, you know, if you're afraid to die, you're already dead. If you're afraid to die, that means you've already decided that this is not worth it, right? Because the consequences of potential failure are worse. So you have to. It's a sign of real commitment, you knowing that what the consequences are and going forward anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea of the other one, if you cannot fail, you cannot succeed, has to do with how do you know you did it right if you don't have in your mind anyway what it would mean to do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't say yes, I've done this if it would have happened anyway. You didn't do it. You can only say I've done this, I've accomplished something, if you know what would happen if you didn't do it. There has to be, you can't win when somebody loses, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, I see both of these as a commitment thing.
Right, exactly.
You've got to commit.
Yeah.
And I think you can see where this preacher thing is hitting in my thoughts.
You want to be a preacher and I want to be a teacher. Okay, so if you do 2, I'm going to do 2. So I'm going to do number 8 and number 7. Number 8, have the courage to admit your mistakes. You know, there's far too many people who just will not take responsibility for their mistakes. There is so much cowardice in making excuses for and blaming others for one's own failures. You know, if you screw up, own it. It is a cornerstone of honor and courage to face the consequences of one's own mistakes.
And if I may throw in here, Jim, that's what scientists do all the time. I mean, most of our experiments don't work. They're mistakes, and we learn from our mistakes.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about a different kind of mistake. Go ahead, Mark.
No, I agree. Actually, I agree with both of those things. But in terms of the phrase, it's a matter of honor and integrity to say, yeah, I messed up. I messed up. People make mistakes. Don't cover it up.
Right. Well, if you screw up, everybody's going to know you did it.
Right.
And no amount of excuse making is going to actually change anybody's mind who is responsible.
And it makes it worse if you try to pretend that it didn't happen.
Right. So the person who is making up the excuses or whatever is actually just making themselves look bad.
Exactly.
And they're placating their own self to feel like, oh, well, I've explained this away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, my number 7, if you are sad, act. Is boredom a problem? Then get off your duff and do something. Go read a book, take a walk, take up a hobby, whatever. The only one that can change a sad state of mind is the person with the sad state of mind. There are many things in one's life that will bring joy. Find them and act.
Right, I think one of the main sort of characteristics of Klingon thought and Klingon approach to life and stuff like that is this act thing. It's a culture of doing stuff. You know, I've said in some other contexts that the Klingon language is kind of verb heavy. That doesn't mean there's more verbs than nouns or anything like that.
But it means it's dependent on that
translating
verb.
Stuff into Klingon. A lot of times, you would describe it in terms of how you do something, not just what something is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, John, you're number 7.
Honor is more important than life.
Which also happens to be my number 3.
I'm sorry?
Which also happens to be my number 3.
Oh, I thought our duplicate was a warrior does not let a friend face danger alone.
Oh, I guess we had 2 that crossed over.
Had 2.
But go ahead.
Okay. The honorable things you do through your life are going to outlive your corporal body. You're going to be known after death by what is remembered of you, what songs are sung, what you have done. So if you've been honorable, you will be remembered for that. If you've been dishonorable, you'll be remembered for that. And that goes beyond how long you live.
Okay.
Right. I think this is a real Klingon-y phrase here, because, you know, as we learn, again, not from the original series, but from Next Generation Deep Space Nine, the importance of honor in Klingon culture, that I think is kind of summed up really well in this little phrase. I can't remember where this phrase came from.
Neither do I, but I can relate to it because I also write books. And I look at the books that I'm writing as, well, they're going to outlive me, so there's something that's going to go into the future with my name on it.
Yeah, this shows how in many, many of the episodes and stories and stuff, it's how important honor is to Klingons.
Okay. Let me see. You know, I might be able to find where that is because I put page numbers down. So 53, and then I can look up and tell you where that's from. If I can get my fumbly fingers to work here. Honor is more important than life. The Next Generation, Sins of the Father. Next Generation's New Ground. And Deep Space Nine, The Way of the Warrior.
Yeah, see? So it came up a few times. That's how important it is.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I'll just wait and do mine later. Okay, my number 6, Klingons don't procrastinate. Another form of this is from the Klingon Art of War. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's my number 6. From the Klingon Art of War by Keith R.A. DeCanado. You've probably met him, haven't you, Mark?
Yeah, I know Keith. Yeah.
You know, attack now or don't attack at all. If something needs to be done and is worth doing, get it done, especially if it is something one has promised to do for someone else.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that particular one, you know, Klingons don't procrastinate, is one of sort of a series of phrases in the thing. Some of them are together on either on the same page or on pages close to each other, and then some are kind of spread out about things that Klingons do or things that Klingons don't do. So the other ones, you know, Klingons do not faint. Klingons do not get sick. Klingons do not lie in bed. Klingons do not procrastinate. Klingons do not surrender, and so on.
All right. So, John, your number six.
Kind of follows along with your number six. Mine is capture all opportunities. When something in life presents itself to you, seize it. Don't let it slip by. You're only going to get so many chances for glory as a Klingon. So go for it. Mm-hmm. Mark?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's sort of a take advantage of what's out there. Keep your options open. If something comes along, grab it because it might not come by again.
Okay. All right. Number five, a warrior does not let a friend face danger alone. Go ahead, John. Were you going to say something?
No, but okay. I can go ahead and comment because that's my number four.
We'll save
another one. So three in common.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll go first, and then John, you go ahead and do your number five, and we'll come back to it. All right. The very definition of friend is being willing to help when needed, and if one has the means. But at the same time, it does not mean that one should always call on a friend for help and never offer it in return. Friends do for others because they want to, not out of obligation.
Well, Jim, I hate to say it, but I got to disagree with you there a little bit. Because as we saw in the episode that brought us back the three Klingons to DS9, Jadzia feels she's got an obligation to help these friends. Despite the fact that her friends are telling her, no, you are not Curzon Dax, you are Jadzia Dax, so you are not honor-bound to help us face this quest. Mm-hmm. And she will just not let it go. She will help them.
That doesn't preclude the fact that she chooses to do so because she wants to. So yeah. maybe two sides of the same coin. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I see it both ways. I think, or sort of what I had in mind with this one is a warrior does not let a friend face danger alone. As a warrior, you're not by yourself. Okay, you're with a group of friends, a group of cohorts, and you, the idea is not that you as an individual triumph over everybody else. It's that you as a group triumph over the other side.
Now, it's an interesting take on that because, Mark, are you familiar with the difference between a warrior and a soldier?
No.
A warrior is a man who's trained to fight and will fight on his own for a cause or with a small group for a cause. But a soldier is trained to stay in the ranks with the rest of his men and act as a unison group. A warrior can act on his own. A soldier stays with his unit.
Right.
And again, I learned that from the SCA.
Yeah. With this thing, there's not that big a difference. So what I mean by that is, as a warrior, yes, we'll go out on his own, but he's not doing it just for himself if there's other people involved, if his friends and so whatever, right?
All right. John, you're number five.
To understand life, endure pain. Seems kind of odd, doesn't it? But how you react to pain, how you react to failure, how you react to adversity tells you a lot about your character, the traits that you have, and the traits that you can improve and grow upon. So to understand your existence, endure the pain that comes with that existence, and move forward.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good way to interpret that one. Another one is to, you can't understand what somebody else is going through unless you've gone through it yourself.
You know, in other words, you're saying walk a mile in somebody else's shoes,
somebody like
and
that.
Hope they're a size smaller.
Right. No. to understand the suffering you're inflicting on other people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. All right, my number four. There is no honor in attacking the weak. It is easy to defeat a weaker party, but what does one gain from that? Nothing at all. Life is full of challenges, and a truly honorable person will choose to take on the tough ones, thereby maintaining as well as increasing their honor.
Right. Yeah. If it's so easy to do that you know ahead of time how it's going to turn out, why bother?
Mm-hmm.
There's no challenge.
You went already without doing anything.
Yeah. See, this is something that I have difficulty getting across to students, especially ones that are just beginning in music, in band.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, try to explain, you know, they'll come back with, oh, this is just too hard. And it's like, well, kid, it's hard because it's worth doing.
Right.
You know, if everybody could do this, everybody would be doing it. But look around you and see how many of the people you know are not sitting here. You know, you're doing something that is difficult, and you will be successful if you keep working at it.
Exactly.
They just don't get it.
In fact, it's one of the principles in The Art of War, looking at it from the point of view of facing a weaker opponent does not allow you as the individual to grow. You need to face someone who is better than you, at mm-hmm. least equal, but most likely better. You will learn, you will gain experience, and you will become a better person for it.
Right, or it's, you know, it's like with lots of things, like when you're with working out in the gym or something. Once you can do everything with 20 pounds, don't say, hey, I can do this with 20 pounds. Go on to 25.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You always increase. So, John, your number four.
Well, we've already talked about it. It's a warrior does not let a friend face danger alone.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a friend of someone and they're going out and trying to do something that is dangerous, your help will always be wanted. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to go out and be soldiers, as I talked about earlier, but mm-hmm. you're going to go out and fight a battle in your own particular styles, but you're going to be reinforcing each other. You're going to be complimenting each other on what it is your strengths are and protecting your friend from their weaknesses. So,
okay.
Right. So this, as much as this perhaps being a commentary about warriors, it's a commentary about friendship. What does that mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because from what I've read of the Klingon culture, every occupation treats what they do like a warrior, in that farmers attack the soil to bring forth a crop. Cobblers attack the leather to bring forth shoes. It's do or do not. Make your best effort.
Mm-hmm. Right. Act.
Right.
All right. My number
Seize
three.
Seize that opportunity.
Yeah. My number three was your number seven, John. Honor is more important than life. But my take is a little different, I think. The person who chooses to truly be honorable and choose an honorable life chooses a difficult and often lonely road to travel. However, that road also leads to great personal achievement and fewer regrets. As poet Robert Frost said, two roads diverged in a wood, and I chose the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Right. Yeah, that's very
good. As opposed to two roads split in the woods and, oh, look, a different way to go. I'm going to forge my own.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'll tell you what, John, don't make fun of Robert Frost.
Just remember, Jim, I think outside the box.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know that. All right. And so, Mark, your take on that was?
It was like what I said before, but I agree with your version of it as well.
Okay. All right, John, you're number three.
There are no old warriors.
I'm going to take issue with that.
Well, except for the fact that if you're talking about age, you can take issue with it.
Okay.
But if you're talking about mentality and outlook, okay, in the SDA, there was nothing more dangerous than an old warrior. Why? Because the youth have vigor and energy, but the old warrior has experience and cunning. So if you think of yourself as old, you will not think of yourself as effective. If you think of yourself as a warrior, you will be effective.
In the Klingon version of this, the word that means old, which is Han, means old in age. However, I think it means, in the context of this phrase, it's more than that. I think it's not a body wearing out or something like that. It has to do with spirit. So the idea is sort of two things. One is, you know, warriors go out and fight and fight to the death, so they don't live to be old, is one take on it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one is that a warrior never stops fighting.
If we look at Deep Space Nine, there's an episode where Kor is not up to his snuff and has been making mistakes, but at the end of the episode, he is going to take on the Jem'Hadar, several ships of it, with a single bird of prey, and is able to do so because he's got the experience and cunning of what
and
in
drive.
The SDA we call
yeah.
and drive,
drive.
To make it happen.
Yeah.
So there's old and then there's old.
There's old and then there's old. There's old you can do nothing about, and there's old that you can do something about.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Well, I like that. Well done, John. Okay. Number two. My number two is no Klingon ever breaks his word. Don't tell someone you're going to do something if you have no intention or will not be able to follow through. It disturbs me how often individuals enthusiastically agree to take part in a project and then they don't do their part. What's even worse are the excuses that come along when confronting such people.
Right. Yeah, this comes from an episode or two, probably of the Next Generation, probably from the mouth of Worf. The Klingons are very honorable in this way too. Of if I say I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. You don't have to worry further.
See, I've taken that to another extreme in my personal life. Is if I say I'm going to do something, I probably got it in my back pocket, done, ready to hand to you.
I'm good, but I'm not that good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if somebody wants me to do something and I have it, I'll say, I'll try.
Uh-huh.
But if I say I'm going to do it, it's done.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the thing is it sometimes it's hard for people to say no. You ask them for something, and they say, oh, yes, I'll take care of that. And, you know, they just haven't learned to just plain say no.
When saying no can mean that person can move on to someone else who might be able to accomplish the job quicker, faster, better.
Yeah. See, I'll tell you what. In my early 20s, I had a lot of problems saying no to people, but I also had the problem of not breaking my word. So I was busy, way too busy, busier than I could afford to be, but I did anyway. Yeah. That one came from Next Generation, two episodes of Next Generation. One was Cost of Living, and the other was New Ground.
It's interesting, right. how some of these popped up in more than one episode. You know, it shows the consistency of the culture, the consistency of the writers.
Yeah, I didn't even realize. As I read through the book, I noticed that there were multiple places, sometimes even multiple series, where the same thing would come up.
And it might not be exactly the same phrasing, but the same thought.
Mm-hmm. All right, John, you're number two.
We fight to enrich the spirit. We take up a challenge to push past the challenge. We accept a difficult task to push our limits above and beyond what they were to make ourselves better.
Right. Yeah, this one was part of my thinking. And this wasn't my thing, it was the writer's thinking. This is another one from an episode. Is we don't fight just to fight. We don't fight just to be mean. We don't fight just to bully. There's much more to it to that. There's a reason for our doing what we're doing.
We actually see this in the Klingon Art of War. Keith talks about it too, is that the reason for fighting is to, literally, as he puts it, enrich the spirit.
Yeah.
All right. My number one, one does not achieve honor while acting dishonorably. I've known a lot of people who will condemn others for their actions while at the same time do the same things they condemn others for. I see this as the ultimate dishonor in people and have no trust in them. The ultimate test of character is how one behaves when no one is watching.
Oh, really good. That's really good. Yeah, this is a sort of an aphorism about hypocrisy, I think, too.
Yeah, that's kind of where I took it.
Yeah.
Okay, and John, you're number one?
Klingon Ma! We are Klingons.
I knew it. I knew that would come up.
It is the best one in your book. It's an affirmation of a lifestyle, of a way of doing things, a way of looking at the world, a way of committing. Everything we've talked about so far today goes into that saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever saw the Klingon version of A Christmas Carol.
I've got a copy of it.
You've got a copy because it's been, you know, it's been, well, it hasn't been running at all recently, but.
No, they have ever since COVID hit.
Right.
They've canceled the production.
It's been going for about 10 years or so.
Yeah.
But the end of it, at the end of it, summing up what this is all about and summing up what Scrooge or Scrooge has gone through and everything else. What they shout out is Klingon Mach. That's what this is.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that they super title that particular play, so you don't have to look at the stage down at the bottom of the stage to know what they're saying.
Right.
All right. So those are our top 10 and interpretations that go with that. I'll tell you what. You know, the book is outstanding for getting some insight into what Klingons are about without having to watch the entire series. I also like the Klingon words that go with it. I think this would also be a real aid in learning to speak Klingon.
Yeah.
So, and I've kind of taken it that way. So,
and of course, all of these things sound much more eloquent in the original Klingon.
Yes.
Yes, they do.
More importantly, I like to throw the pitch out to people. All of these sayings, individually or taken together, like I did with a pair of them here, can be used at conventions to add spice to the character that you're cosplaying out there, the Klingon that you have become. Give a speech, give a sermon, talk about the meaning of these proverbs, and let people see what a Klingon is and can be. Mm-hmm. Preach.
Right. And you know, some of these actually have worked their way into the Christmas Carol, the Klingon Christmas Carol. Which is not lazy writing on the writer's part of that play.
No,
but it is incorporating what it is to be a Klingon into the portrayal of Klingons in that story.
Mm-hmm.
It gives meaning to those phrases that
right.
we see out there.
Right. And since these phrases, you know, are aphorisms, things that Klingons know and Klingons say. I mean, a lot of these things are Worf said, blah blah blah. They should be repeated. You don't just say it once and that's the end of it. It's stuff that Klingons know and say it from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, if you're thinking of taking any of these and turning it into a sermon, remember, Worf has read them. Worf hasn't lived them, so the interpretation of them can be left up to the person discussing them.
Right.
Okay. Well, yeah, and you know, that's the whole thing about sayings like that. They're going to have different meanings for different people. And, you know, as long as you take it in a way that it improves your life or adds to your honor as a person, there is no bad interpretation.
Yeah. Actually, okay. You know, even if you find one or another that you disagree with, think about why. What is your take on this thing?
Yeah.
And maybe you've come up with a new Klingon proverb.
Right. And of course, there's a lot more, I assume, a lot more Klingon proverbs than that were in this book. This book is what is from the mid 90s. It's a long time ago. All kinds of new information has come to light since then.
Oh yes, yeah. Well, not only that, but all the stuff in the books that are coming out, all that. This could be a very thick book after a period of time.
Yeah.
So, Mark, I think we're going to start wrapping this up for today. Do you have any projects in the works at all, or anything you would like to share with the audience?
I have projects. Well, the Klingon language keeps expanding, both through there's sort of two conventions that the Klingon Language Institute has. There's the one that's held normally in the U.S., that the last couple of years has been on Zoom or Discord or something.
The Kep-A.
And there's also one that's been held in Germany for 20 years.
So Levin's got his own convention, eh?
Levin's got his own convention. And last year they skipped it, but this year they're doing it virtually.
For those that don't understand, Levin Letar is the Klingon language teacher in Germany.
Right. And he's prolific. He's published books on his own, translations of things on his own, textbooks. The only textbook that exists, the physical textbook that you can buy in a bookshop, is in German, not in English, other than the Klingon parts, of course. Yeah.
And I believe Levin actually did subtitles for the first season of Star Trek Discovery.
That's right. Yeah, Star Trek Discovery. Here's
in German, in Klingon.
In Klingon, yeah. Star Trek, the first season of Star Trek Discovery, as you know, is very Klingon heavy in terms of the plot.
Yes, it is.
They're all over the place. And it's also Klingon heavy in terms of language. There's more Klingon language in that year of Discovery than there is anywhere else, on screen. Probably more than if you put everything else together, Discovery outweighs it. And I didn't do that. I didn't work on the Klingon for Discovery. It's all the language that I came up with. It's all my words and my grammar and everything else. But I wasn't the one who did the actual translation for the spoken dialogue. That was done by...
For the spoken dialogue, that was Robin Stewart.
It was Robin literally, Stewart for the most part. And it was Alan
she
Anderson.
She literally did cassettes to give to the actors.
Yeah.
So the actors could hear how it was supposed to sound.
Yeah.
But I understand Levin took the non-Klingon words, the English words, and translated them into Klingon for subtitles.
Right, but only, but not in the U.S. or Canada.
No, it was on
Canada. You
could
see the subtitles, but if you had the Netflix version, which was everywhere in the world except the U.S. and Canada. Klingon subtitles. Yeah, Levin did all of that, and Robin and Alan Anderson did the spoken part.
Okay, so any way if someone wants to follow you, Mark, on social media or whatever, how do they look for you there? Are you going to be attending any conventions this year?
The next convention that I'm attending, assuming that it really happens, and as far as I know it will, is Farpoint outside of Baltimore in February. That's the next one I've got coming up. I wouldn't be surprised, although we haven't worked out details yet, if I'll be participating Zoom-wise or something, but with the Kep Home, the Klingon language thing in Germany, which is in November.
Okay. All right. And then any social media contact or anything for you?
I'm very Luddite.
Okay.
I don't All have right. a website or anything.
I know that feeling. I don't know a quarter of the stuff that's on my iPhone.
All right. Well, Mark, I want to thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you. It's been fun. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yes. And I've always wanted to talk to you. I've heard your name hundreds of times, and this has been a really treat. So I'm kind of geeking out here today. And hopefully, maybe in the future, we'll pick up the Klingon Dictionary and invite you to come back and talk to us again.
Great, perfect.
So, if you'll join us, we're going to sign off as we normally do. I am Jajim.
I am Jorn.
And Mark Okrentjik.
And join us next time on Bound by Honor.
Kapla!
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast.
Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Ka-plop!